Hello, everybody, and welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast. This is Peter Ravella, co-host of the show.
And this is Tyler Buckingham, the other co-host.
One of our favorite states on the American Shoreline, Tyler, is Louisiana.
Absolutely.
We have a great show out of Louisiana, of course, Delta Dispatches with Jacques Hébert and Simone Malaz.
We do.
And they always keep us up to date on what's happening in Louisiana.
And they're pumping right now. Let me just say that they have been putting out regular, awesome content for the past, I don't know, 6 weeks or so. Just, it's a great time to be a Delta Dispatches listener.
It is. And there's so much and so many reasons we should pay attention to Louisiana. I think the state with the most aggressive, comprehensive shoreline management program in the United States, billions of dollars on the table, significant coastal management issues, many of which relate to the Mississippi River and the Mississippi River Delta. And we're going to be taking a deep dive into one of the biggest water management and river management issues in Louisiana. And that has to do with the river diversions, the upper river diversions, and the management of the Bonnie Carey Spillway, which pours into Lake Pontchartrain. So we've got an expert to take us down some of the management questions that are being faced there. So I'm really looking forward to this show.
It's oftentimes when we're thinking about the coast, we are obviously thinking about the ocean as the dominant water feature. But yeah, around the American shoreline, whether it's a small inlet, a lagoon, a bay, or the mighty Mississippi, which is, you know, such a major feature on the North American continent, it only makes sense that where this river exits the continent and flows into the ocean, that we would have a major feature on the American shoreline. And right there sits New Orleans. There sits the Louisiana coast. And they are having to figure out how to manage this space. And we have a scientist with us today, Peter, and we're going to dive into some of the state-of-the-art thinking as to what's going on.
Yep, so joining us today is going to be Dr. Devani Carr. She is a senior manager and scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. And she's a great guest for this discussion because the Environmental Defense Fund teamed up with Tulane University to examine the possibility of using upper river diversions, and by these we mean just upriver from New Orleans within the state of Louisiana, but using upper river diversions on the Mississippi River to better manage flood flows coming down the Mississippi River and impacting the habitat on the coast. Huge pulses of freshwater are great in a lot of cases, but they can do some things that are not so great and really affect habitat quality, fisheries, and communities. So right now, one of the major flood diversion management operations is the Bonnie Carey Spillway, which diverts water from the Mississippi River main stem into Lake Pontchartrain, an important habitat area. And those diversions are causing some negative impacts. And Tulane and EDF teamed up to take a closer look at the management strategy and whether new upper river diversions might be helpful. That's the overview. And just real quickly, facts on the table, the Bonnie Carey Spillway, as I said, pours into Lake Pontchartrain. It has been opened 16 times since 1937, but 4 times since March 2018. As climate change and rainfall patterns have changed and the amount of water that floods down the Mississippi is getting more precarious to manage, Tyler, so that's the situation we're going to be talking about.
Well, tell us about our guest.
So, Dr. Devani Carr, senior manager and scientist at EDF, one of the principal players in the development of this upriver analysis. So looking forward to talking to her about this study.
As am I, Peter, but first a quick word from our sponsors.
The American Shoreline Podcast Network and CoastalNewsToday.com are brought to you by LJA Engineering. With 28 offices along the Gulf Coast, the folks at LJA Engineering are at the top of the craft in the areas of coastal restoration, coastal infrastructure, rivers and channels, numerical modeling, disaster recovery, and design and construction oversight. Be sure to subscribe to the Coastal News Today Daily Blast newsletter at CoastalNewsToday.com for daily updates on the events and news that shape the coastal discussion. Want to support the discussion and promote your company? We have sponsorship packages available now. Email me to learn more at chloe@coastalnewstoday.com. That's CHLOE@coastalnewstoday.com. Hope to hear from you and enjoy the show.
Well, hello, Dr. Carr. Welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Tyler.
I hope that that overview was reasonably accurate. Do you have anything to add or change?
No, I think that sums it up pretty much, but I can explain further.
Well, tell us why this is an important issue for the Environmental Defense Fund to get involved with. Introduce us to the organization's interest in the issue and why this study was undertaken.
Absolutely. So Environmental Defense Fund, along with a few other nonprofits, have been working in Louisiana on coastal issues for a long time. We are part of a coalition called the Mississippi River Delta Coalition, and it involves three national nonprofits and two local nonprofits. EDF has an extensive program on climate, as you're aware, on coastal issues. But one of the biggest focuses in Louisiana has been coastal restoration until now. But we are realizing with changing climate and increasing rainfall intensity, sea level rise, there are more critical issues that are coming up right now, and they have to be taken care of urgently. This particular study, actually, the idea came about right after the 2019 floods. There were two back-to-back flooding events, which we call high water events here, where the Bonnie Carey spillway, as you explained, it had to be open, and the water had to be let out to the Pontchartrain, Lake Pontchartrain area. Now, what it does is really, this is a mechanism where you open these gateways and it reduces the flood effects downstream, which is where almost 2 million of people in Louisiana live. But what's happening is with these frequent openings of Bonnie Carey spillway, we're realizing that there's a lot of fresh water that gets into the eastern part of Louisiana as well as Mississippi coast. And we did see there it impacted because of the reducing salinity, because of the fresh water. It's reducing their, it's impacting their fisheries, as well as it's creating a lot of detrimental impacts to the ecosystem there. So this study really came about because we were wondering how best to utilize the diversions, the upper diversions, which were part of the 2017 master plan, but they really hadn't made much progress as to, you know, the feasibility of planning. So they're conceptual diversions right now. So what we did was we looked at, with our modeling team from Tulane, it's led by Dr. Ehab Maselli of Tulane. So what we did was we looked at first how we can manage the water. And that was phase one of the study. And what we found was when the AMA and the Union diversions, if these were operating when the flood situation happens, the reduction in the volume of water that would go through Bonnie Carey was almost 60%. 60.
Wow.
I mean, that's
wow.
Huge, right?
Fantastic.
It's more than half reduction. And we saw that because of this reduction, the salinity impacts were actually much less. So once we completed the water control analysis, the water management analysis, we started looking at what we call the phase two of the study. We started looking at what other benefits there could be, you know, what we call LANIAP in Louisiana. And we saw that at least with the salinity, there was a drastic decrease in the freshening of the water. So when we did our study, initially when we saw that the salinity was, you know, during the flood events would be say 5 ppt. However, when we modeled the study, we saw that when we used these features for the diversions, the salinity stayed above 10 ppt. And this is just running one scenario, right? So we are actually looking at other scenarios where it would depend on how we operate these two diversions.
Dr. Carr, can I interrupt you for a second and request
sure.
request a quick timeout, because I'm trying to understand, just I'm trying to generate a picture in my mind as to what's mm-hmm. happening, and you are covering a tremendous amount of ground here. So what I understand you saying is that there's a way to potentially divert water from the Mississippi River as it flows out to the sea, divert it up river from the Bonnie Carey diversion. And right. that by doing that, the amount of water that would then have to go into Lake Pontchartrain would be less, and that would have a tremendous benefit potentially on the fishery there and the broader ecosystem. So let me ask just a broad question. These other more, I guess, upriver diversions, where would they go? I mean, would they present flooding problems, or do how would that work?
So that's the beauty of this idea is these diversions, they would divert water into the Maurepas Swamp, as well as the Upper Barataria Basin and within Louisiana. What's happening here is we actually need that freshening in Louisiana because we have these coastal forests, we have marshes, and they are all getting, they're deterioorating because of the saltwater intrusion. So it actually, the benefit is then you're getting fresh water where it's needed and reducing the fresh water from where it's not needed, which is Lake Pontchartrain and Mississippi coast. So what happens is when these, the diverting these waters, fresh waters above upriver of Bonnie Carey, the nutrient, the sediment, and all the associated benefits that goes with these diversions is actually kept in Louisiana. So we call it really a win-win situation.
I was going to use that exact phrase. Of course, this is the win-win. As you said, the fresh water needs to go into certain areas that are too salty, that are affecting forests and other coastal habitats that saltwater intrusion is detrimentally affecting. And then to reduce the amount of fresh water into Pontchartrain. Win-win, way to go. Good thinking. The one thing I want to make sure our listeners understand is, why is it important to reduce the amount of water in high flood situations coming down the Mississippi River? And what is the objective of diversions, generally speaking?
So for the water management aspect of it, what it does is really reduces the flood stage, which means if you have high water events coming down on Mississippi, it can spill over, which means flooding in areas like New Orleans and Greater New Orleans and other, you know, the parishes which align next to the river. So aside from the flooding, we do know that the river has been cut off, right, through all the engineering over the years.
Yes.
So what we're really trying to do with these diversions is reconnect the river to its wetlands and coastal forests, where it's actually, you know, over thousands of years. That's how the delta was formed, and that's how these areas were, the habitats and the ecosystem was formed.
Right.
So that's really the purpose of these diversions. The way the state looks at diversions is mainly two goals. One is the freshwater, and one is sediment. And most of them actually have both, both the benefits included, but it just really kind of depends on what's the main focus of that diversion. And so for these diversions, it's really the water management, flood
Understand.
Control.
That makes sense. So the I think most of our listeners are familiar with the engineering, broadly speaking, of the lower Mississippi River and the construction of levees, the channelization, the simplification of the...
I mean, look at it on the map, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't look... When you look at like a natural river delta, it has a very distinctive, like
meander,
a dovetail kind of thing where it spreads out almost 180 degrees on a flat shoreline.
100%.
And when you, and it kind of jets out and it braids. I mean, it's like really kind of like a peacock fanning out.
Yeah, very complex river natural systems, and we've channelized the hell out of it. And
that is not the way it looks when you look at a map of the Mississippi Delta.
We're dumping all of the sediment off of the end of the Crow's Foot, the very out onto the continental shelf, because we funnel so much of the flow and the sediment out of the river and off the end and into the continental shelf. Not good. So the diversions help protect the levee system and the flood risk to the city of New Orleans and the lower river. But really, I think, Dr. Carr, what you're talking about is not only is it a flood risk management opportunity to rethink the river, but it is important habitat relationships between freshwater inflow, salinity, are huge factors, driving factors in the health of fisheries and therefore the health of the coastal economy and coastal communities. I got to think this is a great idea. You say it's a win-win. How is it being received? Is it likely that this initiative will be executed?
So actually, it really gained traction after we finished this study and we kind of showed the initial benefits. That's the, you know, the major reduction in the flood waters going through Manikarri. The CPRA, which is Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, has actually picked up one of these diversions, the Union Diversion, and they are doing a feasibility and planning study to basically look at how to operate this diversion. So different volume flows. So right now it's designed in the master plan as you know, a certain CFS going through these diversions. However, they want to look at different locations, where to site the diversion, and how, you know, basically how to optimize the benefits from these diversions. So one is already on its way, and we are advocating for the other one. We again gaining traction because, you know, we show these benefits from these two diversions. So the outlook is great. I mean, I think it's something that, you know, people as well as the government official, they understand. And we're also trying to explain to our Mississippi, you know, state on our eastern side, that this is actually going to impact them positively, you know, because that was one of the biggest concerns that Mississippi had, is whenever we open out the Manikarri spillway, their fisheries and their ecosystem was getting impacted. So this would definitely improve that situation. And, you know, improve for them and improve our wetlands for us.
Win, win, win. I'm going to throw Mississippi into the winner's column over there, too, which I'm sure they'll appreciate. You talked earlier about the partnership with Tulane. Peter, you talked about it, too. You introduced that beautifully. But Tulane leading kind of this modeling effort. And because my understanding, Dr. Carr, is that these diversions that we're talking about have, I don't believe that they've been actually opened, right? This is all hypothetical, like computer modeling that we're talking about in this study. And I would just really like to know how they do that. You had some very specifics about what the, you know, salinity and like Pontchartrain would be at, you know, 60% reduction, blah, blah, blah. And I would just love to understand kind of the science and how that was accomplished.
Correct. So there are two, like I said earlier, we had two phases of the study. The first study, when we just looked at the water management, this was a model called HECRAS, which is a CORES model, which, I mean, it's really a water budget kind of a model, right? So that's X amount of water comes in, you let out Y amount, what is left is going down, right? So that's the simplified version of it. Now for the phase two of the study, what we call a basin site study, it's a three-dimensional study. And we use a model called Delph 3D. This is a very, very complex and I guess really technical model that
I call that badass. It's a badass model.
Sally can explain this better than I can. But what it does is it looks at, again, the nutrients coming down. So you calculate how many, and nutrients, when I say nutrients, it's all the, you know, the fertilizers and all the nitrogen and all the phosphorus that's coming down the river, which also creates issues for algal blooms in the Gulf of Mexico. So what we're trying to look at is if X amount of that nutrient is taken out upriver of Manikarri, then the reduction in the nutrient that's actually coming down to the Gulf of Mexico is, it's pretty significant. And this, I mean, the assumption is this would help with the, you know, the hypoxia situation there. Delph 3D also looks at water quality, looks at, you know, temperature, oxygen, salinity, like we talked about earlier. And finally, we're also looking at the sediment that's coming down the river and how the sediment budget is impacted by these upper diversions, because they're going to divert that sediment, even though the focus of these diversions is not sediment or, you know, marsh building. These are the benefits, the co-benefits, as we call them. So the Delph 3 model is going to, again, create this kind of a budget that this much is coming down, how much goes out, what is, you know, left.
Very helpful.
So, Yeah, it's a model that's being used by scientists all over who are in coastal studies. And it's again a model that I think once we have finished the complete calibration of the model, it's a very successful model that will be used by the Corps. I mean, they've shown interest. And it could be something that could be used by other coastal states as well.
Fantastic. The study is called Utilizing Upper Diversions in River Water Management Case Study, 2019 Mississippi Floods Phase 2. This is a final report submitted to the Environmental Defense Fund from the researchers at Tulane University, and the study was completed in January 2022. It was the second part, as you say, of a two-part study. For our listeners out there, we've been talking about diversions on the lower Mississippi a few times. It is a topic for Simone Malaz and for Jacques on the Delta Dispatches show. There's been a lot of discussion and controversy about diversions on the lower river, particularly the Mid-Barataria diversion proposal and the Mid-Britain diversion proposal. This is not a discussion about those lower river diversions, which, as you point out, are sediment management and marsh building diversions primarily. These upper river diversions that you're talking about are really distinct, and I just want to make sure folks aren't confused by the idea that all these diversion projects are sort of interconnected. I do want to ask you, though, it seems that these kinds of changes in the Mississippi River management system are incredibly complicated to execute. The Corps of Engineers, of course, is a significant player along with the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, the state agency that leads up coastal restoration efforts in the state. What would it take to make greater use of the Union Freshwater Diversion and the AMA Diversion, the two upriver diversion possibilities that you've mentioned? Did these diversion structures, is it a structure? Do they exist? Would something have to be built? What would it take to execute a greater use of upper river diversions?
Right now they're conceptual diversions and they will have to be built. And the structure would be probably at a smaller scale than the mid-river diversions, which are the Mid-Barataria and Mid-Breton. We're looking at a future 5 to 10 year at least kind of a scenario. They will be newer structures.
If you would include in your description, if there is a sense of cost of what these structures or describe what these structures may look like at this stage, if that's known.
Sense of cost. Now that that's a tricky one because
is it a lot? I think could that be the answer?
Yes, it is.
It's a lot. I think
it is a lot that I would probably say in the billions. I mean, just kind of looking at the Mid-Barataria and Mid-Breton, they're a billion plus. Mid-Barataria is almost a billion and a half. I keep saying million because that's what I'm more familiar with. A billion and a half.
Inflation,
right now.
I'm telling you.
Right. And similarly for Mid-Breton. So these are massive structures, but the upper diversions probably will not be as big. So the costs will be less, but it's really hard to forecast without getting the engineers involved and knowing what the design looks like. But in the the basic design is really you have a cutout in the river and it's a channel that kind of comes out. So for the sediment diversions like Mid-Barataria and Mid-Breton, what we're looking at is where you maximize the sediment, right? So if you have any sandbanks or any kind of areas where the sand collects while the river is flowing, those are the areas you would use. Whereas for the freshwater diversions, which AMA and Union are, these would be areas where we maximize the impact of the freshwater. So kind of looking at what kind of wetlands, what's the receiving area, these will be built around. Really, I can't give you an exact cost or, even ballpark, but I'm assuming it will be in the billion.
It's a conceptual step. And what I, you know, Peter, I don't want to tangle up what you just straightened out, because you did a real nice job of delineating the difference between the sediment projects that we have discussed on this show and what these are. But in a way, they mm-hmm. are connected in the sense that what we're dealing with is we're de-channelizing the Mississippi River.
100%.
And these are, from a policy perspective, the concept here is to engineer diversions, to engineer a delta that more accurately or it does a better job.
More complex,
thinking about the ecosystem that's in the broader region, how it's all interconnected. What I think is interesting is because the other side of the coin that we have heard is just the dredge it, just like ignore these problems, just keep running the current. I would say the current thing, if you got to build the levees a little higher, you build them a little higher, but it's levees and dredging down at the tip, basically, of the river. And I guess all the way throughout, because it's all going to fill up. But the point is that, like, these are different views. And Devyani, as a scientist, as someone who, I'd love to know, like, your approach. Do you think about... is it within bounds as a scientist to think about kind of the natural flow of things as a delta, or are you know what's your approach there?
The approach actually with these diversions is, like I said earlier, mimicking the river, right, as it used to be. We can't really go back and remove all the levees because we have built settlements on these areas, which were never really meant to, sustain. At least the land there. So with sea level rise and subsidence, we know these areas are very, very vulnerable. So the approach is really to kind of, in a way, reverse engineer what has been done since the 50s and 40s, you know, the Corps building out these levees and kind of cutting off the river and putting it in a, so to speak, a straitjacket, right? So it just doesn't have a chance to get out of its banks. So right now what we're doing is we are using engineering methods to reconnect the river with these areas. And that's the beauty of it is, you know, when you talked about the dredging, yes, there are a lot of restoration projects which are built with dredge material either offshore or from the river, but the cost and the life of these projects, you know, because the conditions are constantly changing, like you said, inflation. I mean, it's just something that has to be done again and again. And then you have a storm and everything washes out. And again, you have to start that process again. But what we're doing with these diversions is it's something that's utilizing the natural power of the river to bring sediment down, to bring fresh water. So we're trying to capture what it was, but again, we can't just do it in a natural way. So we call it a nature-based solution, that it is a great infrastructure when you have these diversion gates and structure, but it's also using the river's natural feature.
Yeah, the natural power and the dynamics of the river are the key part of it, trying to restore some of that. Tyler, during the 20th century, as you know, on the coastal America, we spent a lot of time manipulating river systems. And I'll say, just in comparison, the Everglades in Florida was drained, and the hydrology and the hydraulics of the entire southern Florida part of the Florida Peninsula was redone to advance agriculture and development and all of that. That was all the 20th century. This is the Corps of Engineers' heyday of major public project investments in water management. In the 21st century now, what we're trying to do is undo a little bit of the damage and the consequences of these major engineering efforts, while, as you say, Dr. Carr, having to recognize that we have we've basically put ourselves in a position where we can't go back to the natural system, but we can sort of undo some of the most damaging aspects of the simplified hydraulics and hydrology projects that we undertook in the last 100 years. I mean, it just makes good sense to me. Have you heard from, this is a curious question, a little bit political. It has to do with the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser. And the lieutenant governor appeared at the ASBPA conference in New Orleans in October of last year. Tyler and I attended, and at the plenary session, he addressed the coastal engineering community and coastal managers from around the country, and really had a strong objection to the Mid-Barataria Diversion Project and the potential economic and environmental impacts of greater freshwater inflow into certain areas. This is a lower river diversion objection that he was raising. I'm just wondering if you've heard from the state leadership whether they are open to these upper river diversions at this point. Have you got a sense of the receptiveness to this idea?
So the upper river diversions are not as, it's not as big of a political issue yet, A, because they haven't been designed.
Right.
And B, currently the way we're looking at these river diversions are really bringing the freshwater to an area which is sustained by freshwater, right? So it's not kind of changing the whole salinity regime of these areas. The mid diversions are definitely a lot more complex. There's a lot of pushback from, the oyster industry, some fishery, which are kind of more reliant on the brackish or saltier water. However, I think the biggest, what we would say as coastal managers is, if we don't do something now, we're going to lose it all anyway. Right? So you won't have these resources if we don't do something now. So yes, these diversions will have, phase where because of constructions, because of just the kind of beginning of these projects, there will be disturbance. And I think a lot of the opposition to these diversions are because of that. It's just kind of changing things, right? Nobody wants a big change.
Yep.
However, in the long term, and we've all looked at the coastal, the master plan has this famous red maps, right? Where you see the sea level change scenarios and how pretty much all our coast is lost in the next 50, 100 years if we don't do anything. So I think the biggest, the state officials, at least CPRA, and what we are trying to make sure that people understand that, yes, they are going to be growing pains, but without these, what's left? We don't have a coastline to speak of after if we don't do any of these projects.
It's why the situation on the Louisiana coast is so compelling from kind of a national perspective, Peter. It's why we pay such close attention to it. It's that with the investment that Louisiana is making, it is... these projects do cost billions of dollars. That's no joke. Whether we're talking about New York, whether we're talking about Boston, whether we're talking about Miami, whether we're talking about the Houston Ship Channel, whether we're talking about how to manage the Mississippi River, or all around the American shoreline, this is what that NOAA climate change report just indicated.
Is that the
costs of adaptation all over the place are going to be enormous. And so I just think it's really excellent. And Devyani, you said something really, I think, that our audience will really appreciate and that will resonate with them, which is, as coastal planners and as coastal managers, I mean, how many of y'all out there are staring down this barrel of sea level rise? And the good news is we actually do have some good science. We do have some pretty good technique that is being either already investigated, or in this case being modeled. I mean, that's some new technology right there, Peter. I mean, when our ancestors, I'll say, when 100 years ago, let's just say, they are pouring concrete and doing, they didn't have computer modeling. They were spitballing is what they were doing.
Lack of sophistication in terms of understanding the consequences.
I'm not poo-pooing it. That's
a fair criticism. I've
said it before on the show that my grandfather took my father to the Hoover Dam, took the whole family, drove them there. They were proud Americans to witness what American ingenuity and will could do. Stop a river. That was a a thing of pride. And what was interesting to me, getting to your political question, Deviani, I'll be right back to you. But like, what's interesting to me is, will Louisiana get behind, like, as from a pride perspective, the fact that their state is really leading the way here, and that these are really innovative potential projects, and that you have people like Deviani who are super qualified and basically visioning a path forward that is better than just surrender. I'm looking forward to that. Deviani, are you pumped up for that? Are you feeling the wind in your sails as we confront? As you say, I mean, really, we have to do inaction is a no go. We got to do something.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is something we're all so proud of, right? I mean, Louisiana has been kind of at the forefront of climate change, but we've also kind of taken the reins in our hands. And just with the coastal master plans, I mean, no other state has endeavored, at least until now, so sophisticated science-based, and not just, you know, scientists from the state or the country. I mean, we have international scientists who have contributed to these models. We use IPCC and the NOAA models for sea level rise. So yes, absolutely. I think we all who had some small part or big part in, you know, this, so to speak, a revolution of coastal management.
Yeah.
We are very proud. I mean, this is, you know, when you kind of are doing this, you don't think about it much, but looking from the outside, I've talked to people before and it's incredible. It's really amazing what we're doing here. And a lot of other states on the East Coast and Gulf of Mexico, I mean, when they are looking at their own coastal master plans or they are envisioning something, they look to us. And again, I mean, with pride, I can say, I mean, we really have been kind of leading the way.
Can I ask a follow-up question, and which is, if when you look out there at the other states on the American shoreline that are facing their own coastal management issues, do you look at any of them and say, you know, wow, they're really doing, you know, I'm inspired by their job? Does it ever flip for you that you see something, hey, they're really doing great there, we'd like to do something like that in Louisiana?
So, I mean, again, all states are different, right? And they have their own issues. No other state is facing land loss the way Louisiana is. And that's kind of where I think it drives us and the urgency is there.
But the answer is, yes, no. The answer is just a straight up no. Louisiana's in a class of its own, ladies and gentlemen. It's just that simple.
Yes, right. Absolutely. In a lot of ways. But yeah, I think a lot of states are. I think what's unique about Louisiana, though, is how we are planning for it in a cohesive manner, right? We're not just looking at coastal restoration as a science experiment or looking at ecosystem, but we are looking at coastal resilience. We are looking at climate adaptability. So we're looking at jobs. We're looking at the economy of the state that's reliant on our coastal resources. And really, I mean, I think there are a lot of states kind of doing it. And what's been great is now a lot of states have their coastal resilience officer and they have an office of coastal resilience, which really wasn't there before. But what we do is we are tying it into a holistic management, you know, the sophistication of that level is just great because we're looking at climate initiative. We just came out with the climate initiative report. We're looking at it from a watershed management perspective. So all this kind of comes together in Louisiana. And I'm not saying this other states are not doing it, but I think needs to be done is kind of looking at it from a very holistic, a larger view perspective.
Yeah,
that you look at everything together and not just piece by piece.
You know, this show's just firing me up, Peter. I am firing on all cylinders. But let me. You know, I have to say because in my mind, I'm like trying to think of what other states out there, what they're going through. And one thing that I will say, California, this managed retreat business. And to do these diversions that you have here, you need space. You do need land. And this union diversion, to put it in perspective, is about the area where this water would go is about halfway between Baton Rouge and the city of New Orleans along I-10 there. With Peter, we drove that. We drove right through there. And it really, I mean, it is swamp. I think we saw an alligator driving through. I'm not
surely,
kidding.
Yeah, no, it's full-blown, marsh. And I think
you need space.
You need space to do this.
You
need space, and saltwater intrusion is a risk to certain environments, and the freshwater is a positive in the right area. But I really think, Dr. Carr, you're correct. I mean, I think Louisiana is the leading state. And it has to do with the institutional structures. The two things I think that the state is ahead on. One, the institutional management and decision-making structures that have been built, the CPRA, and the integration of the community of experts in the nonprofit community and the federal level, all coming together under this coastal master plan that the state regularly updates. And then funded incredibly well. There's more than $50 billion in project money that is being managed in Louisiana. They're just ahead of everybody. And if you look at Florida, which has significant issues, you just don't see the comprehensive thought process evolving. They're still pecking around the edges. They're still trying to deal with harmful algal blooms, but not really talking to the ag industry and talking about nutrient loading. They're just not quite capable.
They're not ready to bite the bullet.
They're not. Ideologically, they're not open to that.
It's going to cost too much, is what you're saying, and they're just not ready.
They're nibbling on the edges of the problems in Florida, by and large. With the exception of, I would say, the Everglades management, which is a federal effort. But I think Louisiana is the leading coastal management state in the country in a bunch of ways. That's why we love learning what y'all are doing and how you're doing it. So blue ribbon. I'm gonna go with the blue ribbon is awarded by it's the American
gold.
Shoreline Pond. The gold star. You get how many stars? You get five. I think it's
wow.
But
what an honor
it is. But Devani, I think talk to us a little bit about this, about the relationship between the environmental and nonprofit community and the major decision makers when it comes right down to it, the CPRA, the Corps of Engineers. In some states, there's hostility. In some states, there's not respect between the nonprofit community and state and federal leaders. I just don't get that feeling in Louisiana. Talk to us about how EDF and the other organizations you work with fit into the overall decision-making process. Do you guys feel respected and listened to?
Yes, I think just over the years, and over the years, that respect has also grown. I think one of the unique features is probably how we look at environmental management. It's not either or, right? So we're looking at habitat, but we're also looking at coastal communities. We are considering a balance. So we know the reality of, their industries, but we also know that we have to protect the habitat for actually some of the other economies to go forward. So I think we're not just saying like stop everything.
Right.
And, just focused on the environment, but we are more realistic about it. And I think that's really why we're respected and people listen to us, because we are looking at it from both perspectives and not just, kind of saying that this is what you should do, but we try to gather that information, the institutional knowledge, and a lot of people who, as we say, lay people, so to speak. I mean, we don't consider them as lay people because they've been living in this land, they've been fishing, and they've been, their whole cultural heritage. I mean, it's all based on the habitat and the ecosystem around us. And they know a lot. And we just cannot say, okay, this is the way you're going to do it, because it never works, right?
Yeah.
So I really think because of this, the nonprofit community here is so strong. They're advocates, but they're also advocates for the stakeholders, the people, the communities, but they're also advocates for the scientists and, the environmental know-how. So it kind of comes together in that sense. And I feel that maybe in other places, that's the difference is you know, we are kind of part of the stakeholder community here.
Yep. I see it more and more. The Social Coast Forum that Tyler and I were huge fans of hasn't been held because of the pandemic for a few years, but was really about this connection between the professional organizations and class of people who deal with these complex issues and the local communities and the role of the local communities. It's incredibly important that that connection be strong and clear. And we are seeing it more and more, Todd, around the country, I think.
Well, and
it's the right move.
Well, I think it's actually the only move, because the only way that we can advance big, huge, you know, like projects that are going to impact potentially millions of people,
yeah,
is to have a grassroots bottom up consensus that A, action is necessary, and that B, the actions that are taking place are reasonable and going to have positive results. And what we have watched as various ambitious planning projects have occurred around the American shoreline, from, I mentioned Boston earlier, in New York, and we've talked about Miami, and of course New Orleans and Texas, where we're going to turn our attention to in a couple minutes, and the West, everywhere, there is an enormous amount of consideration and opacity. I guess opacity is the word. It's just difficult. People, we're not accustomed. We're learning how to make these investments of adaptation, how to look into the future, trust the data, look at these computer models,
yeah,
like what Dr. Carr and these folks from Tulane have put together, and trust them. And you know, this is kind of a new skill for society, and specifically in America, for our society, for our democracy, which is, you know, can we do this? Can we fund this? Will politicians use these things as footballs for their own mm-hmm. benefit at the expense of actually getting them done?
Yeah,
these are the questions that I think will really be will separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, going forward.
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen. You hope that these processes. What I love about it, Dr. Carr, is that, as you say, the scope of what's being considered and how you define success and the goal of the project is broader now. It's not simply about let's try to reduce flooding. You're talking about let's improve the habitat and communities and fisheries and environmental health in the Lake Pontchartrain region. Let's look at these diversions as positive benefits to other coastal resource areas. Let's do it in a way that's beneficial to communities. This kind of more complex, multi-tiered approach to the benefits of potential investments in this type, that's the magic of it, in my opinion, that you guys bring this holistic view.
Absolutely. And again, my intention is not to say the other states are not doing their best.
We'll say it. You guys are doing the best. But let me tell us, we're coming to the end of this, but I wanted to, if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit more, explain to our audience a little bit more about the areas that, if this project were undertaken, and as you say, it may be a decade, it's not even on the drawing board in terms of a design at this point. There's no design construction funding in place at this moment. But the Union Freshwater Diversion or the AMA Diversion, redirecting water. Tell us about the habitats that will benefit from an increase in freshwater inflow. Introduce us to these areas and the critters.
So these would be primarily with these two diversions, what we call the Upper Barataria Basin. It's one of the most fragile critical habitats in Louisiana. And the other one is the Maurepas Swamp area, which is coastal forest, and it's a freshwater habitat. So we're not just talking about the vegetation, the marsh vegetation, but fisheries, freshwater fisheries. We have, you know, the lifestyle of people here. I mean, it's recreational hunting as well. So you have ducks and alligators, like you said earlier. So these areas are critical habitats for birds. There's a lot of rookeries in these areas, and they support all this flora and fauna around the state. So these these kind of projects will bring the fresh water, keep the salt water out. But in the meantime, they're also bringing in, like I said earlier, some sedimentation, which will help create these marshes, which are, again, crucial habitats for a lot of critters.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, this is a part of the Cajun Louisiana coast, deep-rooted culture that's everything from the shrimp to the oysters to the ducks, all of it. And I'm, let me tell you, I love it. I hope that we can sustain that aspect of the Louisiana coast for generations. I think it's just absolutely iconic. Shifting our attention, I also know that Devyani, you are working on another project with EDF, and this is through the National Academy of Sciences, and it's EDF has teamed up with the Galveston Bay Foundation and Texas A&M. Peter, we're coming over to Texas.
My alma mater.
Sliding over the border. And this has to do with the petrochemical infrastructure around Houston and how the risk of these areas spilling and potentially creating just tons of environmental damage. Devyani, can you talk us through what are you guys working on here? What's the deal?
So this project is, like you said, it's we're working with Texas A&M, the Galveston Bay Foundation, EDF, and then we have other advisory people in the advisory role from Rice University, so on and so forth. The whole goal of this project is to look at petrochemical facilities. There's a big density of these facilities in Texas, Louisiana. So this project, even though the case study is based in Texas, the Galveston Bay, is very applicable to Louisiana as well. So when we start looking at the history of storms and these petrochemical industries, we've seen since Katrina, there have been major spills during these storms. And just in the last couple of years, with Hurricane Ida and Hurricane Laura in Louisiana, Harvey in Texas, this risk has increased many folds. So if this risk was just to, you know, contain to these areas, that would be one thing. But the risk actually spills over, so to speak, to the seafood industry. We have found contaminants in, you know, the fish and the other, you know, like looking at oysters. And so the part of the study is sort of first finding out what kind of contamination is actually entering the food chain. And secondly, is connecting those back to the kind of petrochemical industries which are most at risk because of flooding, either from storm flooding or from intense rainfall. So the project is kind of based in, we call it five aims, which are kind of five parts of the project. The first is, like I said, looking at the fisheries, getting samples from fish. Second is modeling and looking at these the petrochemical facilities that are most at risk. So that would depend on the kind of chemicals, the flood situation, like are they in flood zones or, you know, how much of a risk they are, how vulnerable they are. Thirdly is just their you know, have they been sited in the past? Do they have any kind of business continuity plans? Do they have any kind of spill plans, emergency plans? So putting all these factors together, is we are looking at ranking these facilities. And then finally, the aim 3, 4, and 5, like we call them, is again that focusing on the communities. So which communities are actually going to get impacted, not just from the flood, but from the contaminated flood. So the goal is to sort of focus on that contamination. So air, water, soil, these kind of contaminations.
Wow.
What my focus is as part of the study is looking at the nature-based features and how we can use those features to reduce the risk for these areas. So, you know, looking at wetlands, marshes, looking at barrier islands around these areas to reduce the flood. So yeah, the study is manifold and it's still ongoing, but again, we're using models like Delta 3D, like we talked about earlier. We're looking at other storm surge models. We're looking at models that look at rainfall risk. And then creating these features, like a suite of features, which would best address, in a very economic, optimized way, best address these risks. Now, we know that for certain storms and certain, you know, categories of storms or the strength of storms, these features would not perhaps be as effectual as actually putting gray infrastructure in these areas, which the Corps is doing anyway as part of the coastal study. But what we're looking at is more sort of frequent, but you know, impactful flood events, which are, again, they create the damage, but then with these features, they can be mitigated.
What an important initiative and an important discussion. The Galveston Bay system is the focus of a great deal of attention in the coastal management universe and coastal engineering. As you mentioned, the Corps of Engineers is currently in the process of developing the Coastal Spine Project, a $30 billion plus decade-long, multi-decade initiative to reduce the risk of damage, storm surge, particularly on the petrochemical facilities that surround Galveston Bay. Our good friend Jim Blackburn at the Speed Center at Rice University is a major proponent of reducing this risk, and the Speed Center is a participant in the broad design elements of the Coastal Spine Project, the federal project that is moving forward, it seems. But there's a huge recognition in, I think, in the Galveston Bay system in Houston, the energy capital of the U.S., they call it, that the petrochemical facilities and the risk to the environment of a catastrophic event in the Bay would be enormous. And it's, as you say, it's important because it's not just about Galveston Bay. The petrochemical and oil and gas industry facilities along the Gulf of Mexico, particularly Texas, Louisiana, are huge. And sea level rise, increasing risks. Boy, it's scary to contemplate what could happen if the wrong event hits in the right way. How much damage could be done?
Correct. You know, and this risk is just increasing day by day. So part of our study is not, we're just not looking at only the historical data and historical events, but we are actually projecting to the future, considering climate change, considering increasing intensity of rainfall, increasing temperature. I mean, we're kind of looking at it from a holistic viewpoint. We're building scenarios, looking at different, you know, projections from IPCC and then the new NOAA study that just came out. So yeah, we're building for the future. We're designing for the future. And I think this is something which is very necessary. And, you know, it's not just the communities that are affected, but we're seeing that these areas are surrounded by communities which are low income. They might be more BIPOC communities, and we see that they're disproportionately impacted by these disasters. So one of our major goals is actually to be looking at a more inclusive, more environmental justice focused, you know, when we're looking at these modeling projects. So again, we will be talking to communities. I mean, we have a huge grassroots level effort that we're planning, and we are working with the Galveston Bay Foundation for this project. But yeah, I think it's definitely, now we have to look at people as well. So that's been our goal for this project as well.
Absolutely. You know, the most important and motivating part, I think, as we cover these projects, Peter, it's, these are people projects at the end of the day. They always are. I mean, yep, they're done by us and they're done ultimately for us. And it's just about the equity and how that shakes out. I would love to, this is Peter, Peter's a big golfer, and I'm going to use a golf analogy.
I said big, but not good. I think that's a good, good Peter, choice of good adjective.
Well, I'm thinking about our, green and nature-based infrastructure golf bag. What clubs do we have in this bag? I know we I'm going to brainstorm off the top of my head. We have sand dunes. We have like vegetation on sand dunes. We have oyster beds. We have marshes. We have wetlands. Devyani, when considering a chemical hazard and risk like this, what clubs are we going to be reaching for here? I'm just curious to know. I mean, when you're ultimately the goal is to lay out some options of green and nature-based infrastructure-based mitigation and solutions, what might we be thinking?
So we will be looking at different scales. So, you know, kind of starting from the larger scale, like coastal projects, which would be barrier islands, like you said, the dunes, sand dunes, beach nourishments, which the Corps is doing as part of their...
It's like a driver.
Yeah. but wetlands and, you know, all of those you mentioned. However, we're also looking at more neighborhood scale projects as well. So, you know, when you have this contamination, kind of having these areas as sponges, so you have retention ponds, looking at smaller scale but more effective. I mean, we're considering a whole suite. You're looking at rain gardens, you're looking at everything in its own way can contribute. And some of these things are not even expensive. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, even thousands or millions of dollars. These are all neighborhood projects which would actually benefit the neighborhood or the communities, aesthetic, increase their property values of these areas, as well as help with the mitigating at least the smaller size floods, which are, again, frequent, but you know, they do cost or they create damage.
The good work of the Environmental Defense Fund and so many other organizations that are trying to tackle these complex problems on the American shoreline. If folks are interested in following along with your work at EDF, how can they keep up with your work, Dr. Carr?
The best way is to go to our website. We have project-focused pages. We have blogs. We're very prolific with blogs, so please check them out. And you will see a lot of them are linked to other studies that are in various areas, you know, and how we connect with other parts of our organization, with the oceans folks and with the climate change folks. So I think that would be a great way to kind of look out. And then we do come out with, you know, like for Louisiana work, Delta Dispatch, that's like a fantastic opportunity to go and learn more about Louisiana and the work we're doing here. Restore the Mississippi River Delta Coalition's website. We have projects, you can learn about the staff, you can learn about their background and interests. So there's a lot of resources, you know, you can look at, and of course news. Right now,
yeah, Coastal News,
like,
Today,
you know,
we cover
happening times, so to speak, in coastal restoration. So, you know, we're trying to get the word out there that how urgent this is and how much we can do, and we're doing, but there's still a lot to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Dr. Devyani Carr. She is the senior manager and scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund's office in New Orleans, and an expert on one of the most amazing initiatives out there, the management of the Lower Mississippi River Delta area, and how to keep it healthy, how to make it economically strong, and how to make it support our communities, reduce the risks we all face from climate change and sea level rise. What a great coastal professional. Thank you so much, Dr. Carr, for sharing your insights with us and our audience on the American Shoreline Podcast. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you, and likewise.